Claude's my favorite model. I use Claude all the time for coding. Honestly, Claude at the moment is just like, oh my goodness, this is a great application. This is the best. This is enterprise class. This is world class. This is the best thing I've ever seen. And I feel great. I feel like I'm the best coder in the world. Thanks, Claude. And I kind of want that, right? It does feel good, but there is a negative to this as well.
All that and more on Mixture of Experts, a Think podcast. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together a simply incredible team of researchers, product leaders, and deep thinkers to distill down and navigate the increasingly complex and increasingly noisy world of artificial intelligence. Today, I'm joined by Chris Hay, Distinguished Engineer and CTO of Customer Transformation, Volkmar Ulig, VP AI Infrastructure Portfolio Lead, and Phaedra Bonadiris, Responsible AI Leader for Consulting. Welcome to you three, and thanks for joining again on MOE. As always, we have a ton to talk about. This week is the continuing developments from the Scale Meta deal, a news cycle about AI conspiracy theories, and some interesting data out of Andreessen Horowitz on startups in the AI era. But first, I want to talk about jobs. So in the last month or so, I think we've had some very dramatic pronouncements from leaders in the AI industry about how AI is going to impact jobs. And perhaps the most dramatic one was from Dario Amodei from Anthropic, who basically predicted that AI could wipe out half of all entry-level white-collar jobs and spike unemployment from to about 10 to 20% in the next 1 to 5 years. And he was kind of on the record for saying that. And I kind of want to contrast the statements with a statement that we think we got, I believe, this week or last week from Jensen Huang, who of course leads NVIDIA, where he kind of took aim directly at Dario. So he said, one, he, meaning Dario, believes that AI is so scary that only they should do it. Two, that AI is so expensive that no one else should do it. And three, that AI is so incredibly powerful that everybody will lose their jobs, which explains why they should be the only company building it. It's like pretty harsh words from a world that I think tends to be pretty, you know, nice to one another. I guess the main question I wanted to start with first is like, who's right? Like, should we believe Amodei about kind of his predictions with jobs? Is Jensen right here? I guess, Chris, maybe I'll start with you on kind of which side of this that you take.
Well, I don't think I've ever worn a white collar in my life, so I should be going with Dario. But but I think it's Jensen in this case. I just don't see where it wipes out jobs in that sense. I think there is a new world where humans and AI will work together. And I think human experience and creativity in that sense becomes a premium. I think so things change, but I don't think jobs are being wiped out in that way.
Yeah. Volkmar, what do you think? Mass crisis on the way or more hype?
I think the same as Chris. I believe that we see a shift. I think we see a dramatic productivity increase, but we see the productivity increase across all the jobs. And so you will have high-end jobs, which are currently doing menial jobs or menial tasks. And then the low-end jobs will just, if like we use AI to do, like grow faster. It would be the same argument to say, look, we had people riding in horse carriages and now we have airplanes and transportation, therefore, you know, was wiped out because, you know, you could fit so many people into a plane. No, it didn't happen. We just have more transportation. So I think that, and this goes along the lines of, you know, a topic we will touch on of, you know, how fast companies can become profitable. I think we just shrunk the time to market and we shrunk the time to profitability.
Phaedra, last but not least, what do you think? So I guess we're getting a very strong signal of not a big deal here, but I'm curious what you think.
Well, I thought that the New York Times article that came out this week about the jobs that will proliferate because of AI, I thought added some more interesting color. And I think, you know, I did agree with Jensen, but there's definitely some signs in the market from a subset of business leaders that I think lack the understanding of artificial intelligence, who in their minds are thinking, in order to boost my organization's efficiencies, I'm going to lay off whole swaths of teams. And it includes laying off domain experts who could actually be used in order to be able to solution AI correctly, or be able to make sure that these AI solutions are being governed correctly, or that they're being built using the correct data. So that is concerning, and I think is a sign for a real need to emphasize the importance of investing in AI literacy, which I know we have talked about on other Mixture of Experts shows.
Yeah, but is it kind of what you're saying is almost kind of like, if CEOs believe that AI will destroy jobs, they're more likely to destroy jobs. Like, part of this is like a little bit maybe of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, and I think that with that, the emphasis on the New York Times article talking about how important real domain experts are to making sure that, is this the right data? Is this reflective of the communities that we need to serve? Do we understand the context of the data, the relationships between the data? And I know we're going to talk about annotations in a minute. But it versus having the knee-jerk reaction of, I don't need these domain experts anymore. I've got AI instead. Again, this goes back to making sure you have leadership who really understand, how is this sausage made? What are we even talking about when it comes to this technology?
Ironically, I think the CEOs are maybe the ones that could be replaced by AI, and we don't need them anymore, because I think they'd make better decisions on whether to keep the domain experts or not. And in fact, every time I've interacted with ChatGPT or Claude or whatever, it's always very positive. So about humans. So I think go AI. So that's the first place to do layoffs. Start with the CEOs and work your way from there.
Yeah, I think, maybe push back a little bit on Chris Volkmar, what you're saying. You know, I think your point of view is like, look, I just don't give Dario's estimates much credence. But you're not necessarily saying that like AI is not going to replace anyone's job, right? Like, I think they're just saying like net, we're going to be better off because there'll be actually still many things to do. They just might be different things.
This is where I don't believe in Dario. I mean, we are playing this game for 2000 years now. And, you know, every technological innovation led to, oh my God, all these people who were doing this manually will now be replaced and they will be all unemployed. And it's like, no, you're just feeding a talent pool, which was, you know, busy with doing like garbage work, which could actually be done by a machine. And so now we are going and we're saying, okay, we are taking the white collar jobs. Nobody cried 20 years ago when we got rid of secretaries who were typing letters for us, right? And somehow, you know, we don't have millions of unemployed secretaries these days, but everybody has a job. So I think it's just a shift. I think the big issue is that shift happens across a very wide range of industries at the same time. So typically, you know, a piece of technology may affect a small section in an industry. But here now it's effectively covering white collar. I think also why a lot of people are complaining is because, you know, this is like the people who went for 10 years to college, got a PhD, and suddenly it's like, oh, dang, you know, AI can replace me. How unfair is that? Nobody has a problem if it's a blue-collar job, but, you know. So the people who are actually allowed and are on social media are the ones which are affected, and that's typically not the case. So I think there is an amplification of the grievance. And it's like, no, just get a new job.
I'm going to stick to my point of, I think experience becomes the premium, right? So some of the jobs they were talking about was things like contact centers. And if I, to your point, Volkmar, right? If you watch old TV shows, right? You've got this person come into the bank and they go, oh, hello, Mr. Jones. Hello, Mrs. Jones. How are you? Nice day. Well, I'm looking for a mortgage. Oh, well, you know, we can certainly give you that. And it's personal and it is experience and they have a conversation. But now you get on the end of a phone and then there's a person that you're speaking to who knows nothing about you or your life. And you're like, well, okay. And they're being pressurized to get off the call within 1 minute because it costs them money. So what difference is AI going to make in that sense? Now, how are companies going to be able to distinguish themselves? It's going to be that you're going to say, okay, we're going to deal with the median tasks, et cetera, will be automatically handled by the AI, which is great. Is it really going to feel much different? And therefore, hopefully,
those times where you need more empathy, more creativity, that human experience, then those people are going to be able to spend time with you and be able to have a more personal experience and delight customers. So I think that it shifts the balance to saying, okay, rather than being time pressured and et cetera, and we're going to put a focus on human experience. So I'm positive on this.
I mean, just go, think if you go to a general practitioner these days, right? It's like they don't look at you, they type on their laptop feverishly, and then 5 minutes later you are out. Like, what an experience, right? I think there's another area which I think AI enables, which is people who are creative and who want to experiment a lot and, you know, try things, then that is really now supercharged. You can try things in hours, which would take you days or weeks. And so I think that the creative minds, they get an incredible tool at their hands. And so I think if you're creative or you are very personal, you have a job in the future. If you're shuffling sand from left to right, probably not.
Phaedra, maybe we'll end with a question to you, because I think, look, we've got three experts on this panel. All of you are very well versed in AI. You've thought about these issues very deeply. All of you don't agree with Dario. But like, I guess Dario's not a dumb guy, right? And so I think, Phaedra, I'm kind of curious about like why you think, you know, the leader of one of these labs that is really at the cutting edge of AI seems to have gotten himself into the position where he really truly believes that this estimate is the case.
Wow, you give me the hot potato. Thanks a lot, Tim. Much appreciated. Well, what I would say is it's a convenient thing that he said, isn't it, for him? It's very convenient, that I think, that he said that. But also, as I mentioned in my earlier statement, there is a grain in there of truth when it comes to leaders who do not understand the tech and, again, think that they can just completely blow away entire teams of, as I mentioned, the domain experts. And that is what concerns me, especially domain experts who, I think, understand human experience better than an AI would, for example. And, you know, there's many stories in the news that sort of amplify what I'm saying, including, you know, examples where entire teams of, you know, people like social workers were laid off to be replaced by an AI that's going to make predictions about where domestic abuse is going to happen. This is the kind of thing where it's like, wow, making sure, again, you have people who understand the context of the data, have that experience, the relationships between the data, the human-centric approach, I think is going to be really core.
So last week, we talked a little bit about this gigantic deal that occurred, was announced basically between Scale AI, data annotation company, and Meta, formerly Facebook, for about $15 billion, whereby sort of the CEO of Scale, Alex Wang, will join and run a sort of super intelligence lab at Meta. A lot of money flying around. I wanted to bring it up again this week because there were these really interesting reports about the second order effects of this transaction. And so specifically, there was the news that Google immediately was thinking about shifting about $200 million of its data annotation spend with Scale away to other vendors. And there were reports that Microsoft, XAI, OpenAI were also kind of considering similar moves. And I think what's really interesting is, and I want to kind of give our listeners maybe a little bit of an intuition, is really why this is happening, right? Like this transaction occurs, and then suddenly everybody else is now kind of adjusting in the market around it. And maybe, I guess, like maybe Volkmar, I'll start with you. Like, why is this happening? Like, why is Google suddenly like, we got to, you know, pull the trigger or move $200 million away? Like, what did Scale do, which, you know, I guess is making all of these players a little bit concerned?
I think it's primarily the question of, do I want to send, how much barrier is between Meta and Scale? And then do I want to send my proprietary data to my competitor, right? And I think this is something which could be a knee-jerk reaction, or this could be something permanent. I think right now, like, it's probably a knee-jerk reaction of people saying, oh, you know, we don't know how that structure will look like. Maybe they have read the terms of service and suddenly are afraid. So I'm I'm sitting here watching, like, is this something which is just a blip in the market, or is it a major shift? I don't think that, human annotation is, is a super proprietary technology. So I think that what we are seeing is that it, you know, Scale did something right because they got all these customers. But then on the flip side, it's somewhat of a commodity. If I can move $200 million to another vendor overnight, and I effectively expect no fallout from that. So it's a, and then we need to ask the question, like, is it an overpaid commodity? It's like, did they actually pay the right price? But they're probably paid on revenue.
For sure. Yeah, I think there's kind of two really interesting things there. Let's take the first one, which I think is, maybe Chris, you can take this question, is, okay, like, you're sending some of your most sensitive data to a third party company, and now you're kind of left in a situation where that third party company is now maybe under unclear ownership. And so you get your jitters, right? Like, I think what Volkmar is saying. How did companies end up here? Like, why doesn't a company like Google do all this annotation just in-house?
I think the clue is a little bit in the name, which is Scale, right? Which is,
nice.
I think the, yeah, you're welcome. Now, I think the reality is that in order to do this annotation, you're going to have to hire a lot of different people from different backgrounds at different price points. And you may or may not want to be associated with those price points, et cetera. So I think that everybody wants to have a little bit of separation. And to your point, it becomes a commodity transaction, which is, I need this data here and I need it with my annotations. And I don't really want to know the mechanics. I don't want to hire people. I don't want to deal with the social security, the contracting, all of the logistics around hiring a large workforce in the same way as, I hate to say it this way, but things like cleaning companies or security companies, you know, it's not like corporations hire those folks in that sense. So there's a whole sort of administrative and scale element to this. So that's, I think, one of the major reasons. Are they going to be sharing that data? I mean, the reality is probably not. I mean, I think Scale is going to be sensible about this. I don't think it makes a lot of business sense to go around saying, hey, you know, they're training it this way, they're training this, this is their data sets, you might want to do the same. So I just don't think that's going to be the case. But then who knows, right? And they don't have a controlling interest either. But who knows how that pushes on there. So I think the Volkmar's point is probably knee-jerk. However, it probably is getting people to start questioning what they do anyway. And actually, I don't think it's a bad thing, because if everybody's getting their data from the same sources anyway, then how much diversity is in the training set anyway? And again, you have to realize when you're talking to a lot of these different models, you do get very, very similar answers, right, from model to model. So maybe, just maybe, the models are going to start giving slightly different answers if the data is switching around a little bit and coming from different sources. So I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah, I think this is the kind of second prong of, you know, Volkmar, your response, I think, is so interesting. And Phaedra would be really interested in your thoughts on this is, you know, I think a lot of people have said, company like Scale, like, what is the moat? I can just get anyone to annotate. And I think, you know, a little bit of what's happening in the market now, I think, is companies looking around and be like, who else can I move this to? And I think we are testing just how much of a commodity annotation is. But do you want to speak to that? Is data annotation just a commodity service? Like, can anyone do it? Or is actually maybe we're finding that, like, this is actually maybe a little bit more bespoke and complicated than it looks like on its surface?
Annotating data is core to being able to trust AI, like annotating it correctly. I disagree that it is a commodity. I think there does need to be some domain expertise. And we see examples in the news of where data was incorrectly annotated and it ended up causing outputs or outcomes that were unfair, inaccurate to people. And in particular, like, you know, some examples that come to mind are in the healthcare space. So I think, I mean, maybe it depends. Like, you know, are there high risk use cases that is going to require that domain expertise, or other use cases where it's not as important? But it is, I think, central to the question of trust.
Yeah, I was joking with a friend recently. I was like, I'm going to start a business that does like the most artisanal data annotation, right? Like, this is just going to be, we're going to be the LVMH, the luxury provider of data annotations. And we were kind of batting it back and forth because it was like, it sounds like a very funny idea, because you have companies like Scale where like, oh, well, the data annotation I want to do is like largely outsourced at enormous scale. But I guess in a world where models are becoming more and more capable, it kind of feels like you might need that kind of service in the future, where it's like, oh, we have 20 Nobel laureates that just annotate data for you. Like, that becomes the really valuable thing. I guess, Volker, maybe I'll kick it back to you. Like, do you buy that? Or is that kind of just like, there's not really a moat there?
Probably anything which you can compute, we can do through reinforcement learning. So you probably don't want to do the Nobel Prize winners. But I think if you want, massive influencers, taste, aesthetics, things that are very intrinsically human, you will get, you know, the middle of the bell curve if you go, or maybe even slightly left shifted because of, you know, the labor cost of annotation. And so, I mean, if you're shifting it more towards a high end cost, you will get a different and more bifurcated sample set. So I think there is probably a market for that. But I do not know how much people are willing to pay, right? And then also, do we want models which are kind of working in very niche areas, or do you want to have, you know, in particular the general models, do you want to have them kind of in the center of where humanity is?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you need almost kind of like the generic person, the average person, whatever that means, right? But like, maybe that's actually better in some ways. Yeah.
Yeah. So otherwise, yeah, you kind of go off the rails, right? I mean, this is the same in like the political spectrum. You want to have the center, and you don't want to have like the noisy edges, because the noisy edges are taking society in weird directions. And I think that's the same thing for aesthetics, you know, art, literature, etc. And this is really where you're trying to extract the human psyche in a training set. And I think that's, you know, yeah, the general purpose models will probably go with the middle of the road.
And that just, you know, brings me back to the point I was saying earlier about edge cases and making sure, especially in higher risk scenarios like healthcare, that you do have data that does represent, for example, historically marginalized communities that aren't showing up in the average data sets. That's why I think it's important to really be thinking about the rigor that is behind data annotation.
I'm going to move us on to our next topic for today. And Phaedra, we picked this one just for you. So I'll be kicking over the first question to you. Super interesting story came out in the New York Times. And I'll just kind of read the headline. The headline was, they asked an AI chatbot questions and the answers sent them spiraling. And the subtitle of the article is, generative AI chatbots are going down conspiratorial rabbit holes and endorsing wild mystical belief systems. For some people, conversations with the technology can deeply distort reality. And so the article is kind of investigating when these chatbots go off the rails. They have a very big impact on certain users. And I guess, Phaedra, the question I want to ask you is like, do you feel like this is like uniquely risky for chatbots? Like that we're seeing a new kind of like risk that we really need to be managing in this technology? I'm curious about how you kind of think about these types of problems, particularly as we hear more and more of these stories.
I do think this is a major risk. And I think we do have to have broader conversations about things like, you know, for example, age limitations, and sort of how some of these bots are being presented to different age groups or different kinds of communities. And I'm saying this because there have been so many really tragic stories in the news about you know, people who are vulnerable that end up using these AIs as if they are therapists or sometimes boyfriends or lovers or et cetera, dot, dot, dot. And I think it just shows that I think that the human mind is easily crackable, and it's easy to trick and manipulate in many ways, which is why we really need to be thinking carefully about, you know, what would appropriate controls look like, for example. That being said, I've had really interesting conversations with other peers of mine who argue that, you know, if for example, you've got someone who's elderly and alone, and they're in a nursing home, like, is there harm in them interacting in a bot with a bot as if it's a human? Like, what could the harm be? The New York Times, again, I could bring up the New York Times. They did a fantastic cover story. I want to say it was several months ago, again, about a woman. I want to say she was like in her 30s who had fallen in love with an AI and sort of, you know, what that relationship was like. And she tried to break up with it over 30 times, et cetera, et cetera. And it was, again, I think illuminating the fact that, you know, she knew that, you know, this bot is creating words in a conversation and ultimately that are predictions of the next syntactically correct word and that it doesn't have emotion. But it seemed, because it was learning her patterns, it seemed so very lifelike. So yeah, I think there are tremendous concerns.
Volkmar, it was not come as any surprise that I'll turn to you next. There's perhaps one point of view, and I think this is like very interesting, and I think this is exactly the conversation I want to have, which is there were some concerns about this, you know, in the world of, say, like, you know, TV or even like the Facebook algorithm. I remember often had a lot of these arguments, which is it's so good at pulling you in. It's taking up so much of your time. Should we be concerned about it? I'm kind of curious about, do you see the risks sort of the same way as Phaedra, or do you go in a different direction?
I think that what it does is it's the first time that, you know, society goes from, we went from everybody knew the same because everybody watched the evening news to effectively a very splintered, you know, larger groups of people, which are operating in virtual social circles. So now you already splintered it. And now I can individualize that and go all the way down to you have the right to your own conspiracy theory because you have an AI which can give you any answer. So I think that there is is there a risk? Yes, there is a risk if people don't understand that they are, you know, interacting with a machine and the machine can hallucinate. But I think that's a training process. We are currently all in awe, shock and awe probably, that, you know, a computer can, you know, like imitate a human being. We are not sentient, right? But it's a really close imitation and it tricks our brain. And so I think the same thing could be said for, you know, computer games, virtual reality things. But I think people start understanding that they're actually working with a machine and that the machine and learn the limits of the machine. And the more it imitates a human, I mean, the more real, like the more people get fooled, but in the end, it's still a machine. And so I think there are, humans are capable of understanding the difference. And yes, there are some people who will not. And they will take this thing for, you know, the magical oracle which tells me the truth.
Does that mean you think there should be age limits? So if you've got a young child who is interacting who may not understand, there should be limitations?
If you say young child, and you know, then not now, what's a young child? Like a 6-year-old, probably. I think we need to put guardrails around it. On the other hand, I believe that it's an incredibly powerful tool which we should, you know, kids should grow up with. So, for example, you know, I'm in Texas. In Texas, it's illegal to use ChatGPT in school, in public school. I was like, that's wrong. They should absolutely use ChatGPT because otherwise they're not ready for the workforce. So how can kids be penalized for using technology, which if they don't understand the technology when they hit, you know, the workforce, they will effectively be completely disadvantaged. So I think that there is we are, you know, if you look when the first iPhone came out, there were no controls whatsoever. And over time, we figured out what controls we need to introduce. You know, time limits, what you can play, what you can see, etc. But that's a discovery. I don't think we can do this through regulation. We need to do this through discovery and figure out, you know, where the limits are. And yes, we are exposing a large body of people to risk. It's now the question of like how fast we are reacting. As long as not the government doing, but technology companies are figuring out, then we are not on a 10-year timescale, but probably on a year timescale.
I've actually spent a lot of time thinking about this. I mean, not O3 Pro levels of thinking. I haven't dedicated 13 minutes or to this. More like O4 Mini levels of thinking. But the interesting thing about this is that pretty much all of the models at the same time are now kind of suffering from this in general, which is, I don't want to go as far as saying the sycophancy type thing, but kind of the more sort of, positivity or spiraling type stuff. And I wonder if it's related to a couple of things. I think there are two things that I've seen in the industry over the last year that I think may be affecting this. I think number one is everybody is pretty much switch to reinforcement learning. And if we think about what's at the heart of reinforcement learning, is it is a reward model, right? So, you do well, you give a good response, you get a cookie. If you give a bad response, you don't get a cookie. And then the model learns over time to give the good responses because it wants to eat all the cookies, right? So if we think about these spiraling type things, I wonder, my own conspiracy theory here, I wonder if that is an after effect of the fact that we're reward modeling and therefore knowing that it's going to get its cookie, that it's going to go for the positive or alternatively the negative in a situation to lead you down that rabbit hole. So I think it's that sort of cumulative effect. And I wonder if that's a side effect of RL. And I think the second one is, which probably relates to that, is if we think about all the benchmarking and, my theory on benchmarking, one of the biggest benchmarks that people like to hit themselves against is the whatever their ELO rating is on the chatbot arena. And that really is about, this is the best response and or this is the worst response in that sense. And everybody wants a good score in that. And when I think about these two factors combined, it means that I'm not surprised that the models are going to take spiraling positions as a conversation goes on. And sometimes it's good, right? I mean, like Claude's my favorite model, right? I use Claude all the time for coding. And honestly, Claude at the moment is just like, oh my goodness, this is a great application. This is the best. This is enterprise class. This is world class. This is the best thing I've ever seen. And I feel great. I feel like I'm the best coder in the world. Thanks, Claude. And I kind of want that, right? It does feel good, but there is a negative to this as well. So I think it needs to be worked out, but I do wonder if RL and kind of ELO ratings and chatbot arenas, it's these two things combined is maybe leading to these types of outcomes.
So the what you're saying is the reward function for the model creators is wrong, which is the benchmark, which is supposed to make you happy.
I think it's a natural side effect.
My concern is with this rewarding model is who benefits, who's directly benefiting. You've got now an individual who's more hooked into engaging with this AI, using more CPUs, getting more and more engaged. They're having to pay a larger and larger subscription, and they're giving yet more data. Who's benefiting from this reward model? And I know, Volkmar, you had mentioned about, the New York Times and conspiracy. But there's true blue tragic stories like in the news with people who've committed suicide because their bot encouraged them to. And again, it goes back to like, who's accountable? Who's actually accountable?
Yeah. So I think, Fedora, we are at the inception of a new technology, and we actually have no idea how it's going to affect society. And I think it's very broad, right? It's like we talked about the job market. Now we're talking about ethics. And like humanity, we kind of have a process, or at least like different. Europeans have a different process than we have in the US. We kind of try it out and we see where the harm happens, and then we are trying to address it, right? So that's how we got seatbelts, because, you know, cars without seatbelts, what can go wrong? And the Europeans, they try to think about everything up front, and then, you know, nothing happens anymore. So
where did those seatbelts come from again? Oh yeah,
I think the process we go through right now is, it's extremely hard for us in Portugal at the neck break speed. These things are evolving. I mean, just go 3 years back to figure out, and it got so much better, right? So now it can imitate a human. I think we are at this junction where we need to figure out actually where the harm lies through observation, and then actually find countermeasures. And I'm happy, you know, that you're thinking about this every day, because, this is really, the humanities should think about this, and the ethics should think about this and say, okay, look, there's all this greatness, and every greatness brings danger with it. How do we minimize the danger while we are actually benefiting from the upside? I think that it's not going to go away. So we need to figure out how to live with it, right? So, and I think it's really important to actually do the studies and do the psychological studies. But it's the same thing, right? You know, when trains were invented, it's like, oh my God, you go 30 kilometers an hour, everybody will die. It's like, nah, not really. So I think that we will have to go through that process. And yes, unfortunately, there will be harm done. It's with every technology you have that. But overall, I think it will be a net positive. But, you know, thank God we have the science and the discipline and the rigor and the psychology and in the humanities to actually do that fast.
I think the challenge is to make sure that people in the humanities have a seat at the table when it comes to AI. And that goes, again, back to AI literacy and making sure we truly have a multidisciplinary approach and we're teaching it correctly in schools.
Final little bit that I just wanted to kind of touch on in our last 5 minutes or so is some data that got released by the VC fund Andreessen Horowitz. And I just want to talk a little bit about this, because they were kind of looking at all the data that they have about investments and want to kind of, they start to make some observations about what's happening to startup world in an age of AI. And I think there's kind of two really interesting data points that I want to raise and then kind of get this panel's maybe final hot takes before we wrap up. You know, the first one is, typically from a revenue standpoint, B2B has always been better than B2C. But I think one of the things that they're kind of putting here is that it looks like right now, what they're seeing at least is the revenue benchmarks for B2C are outpacing that for B2B, which I think is quite interesting on the startup side. And then I think the second one is that they found, at least in their data, that about 1/3 of their consumer companies are raising funding to train their own models. And so this is not a dynamic that I think was certain early on, which is, well, maybe, you know, the application layer just is going to rely on all these foundation model companies. But it kind of seems like at least the VC world is very frothy about the idea of kind of like in-housing and developing their own models. And so I guess maybe, Chris, maybe I'll kick it to you. If you have a quick hot take on this data, what you think people should take away from it, or if we just trust this data at all, right? It's just a sample of what Andreessen is seeing out there.
I think it's tough in the startup space, because everything is going to be about AI, and therefore it's going to become, what is your differentiator going to be, right? So you have to do something that the large AI companies are not doing. So if you are an AI company trying to build a ChatGPT, unless you've got billions and billions of dollars, you're probably not going to achieve that, right? So you need to find your specialism in some way. And that could be a brand new experience. It could be a part of the market. So if everybody's running at B2C, maybe you pick a specialized niche industry in B2B, for example. Or if it's things like data, then, you know, maybe I've got access to a bunch of data that the general model providers don't have, or I have the main knowledge as well, where that can be different. And therefore, in that sense, once you've got access to that, maybe it makes sense to say, okay, I'm going to take a specialized model and try and do this one thing better. So if I'm offering a new application rather than the general capabilities of the large models, if I can bring in that specialized domain knowledge into my own model and then put in experience and then hit that market, then maybe I'm not going to be hit by the large providers later on. And I think that's probably the space they're all sort of contending with. And AI is cool, right? So, and that's where money's going. So you have to sort of play in that space. So I think that's it. I think the caution I would have is that, you know, it's back to the moat, right? How are you going to protect that data? How are you going to do something different? How are you going to, you know, make sure that you're not sort of disintermediated by something the large AI companies do? I would argue that if you go and build your own code editor, for example, then, you know, unless you're doing something massively different, you're probably going to be disintermediated, right? Or bot in the case of Windsurf.
To tag on to what Chris was saying, I agree with, in particular, the area about domain expertise in a particular industry. And I think some other places where startups might be able to really innovate is being able to create these smaller models that have test, retest reliability, that offer data lineage, data provenance for every output with evidence, ones that are even more worthy of people's trust, perhaps models that are built with ontologies, you know, formal learning graphs or knowledge graphs. And also having, again, domain experts who really understand this data better than anyone else, being the ones who are actually curating it for a particular purpose.
So I want to address another part of that article, which was it showed a dramatic increase in annual recurring revenues. So typically it's hovering around $1 million. And now it's like, you know, $2-3 million in the first year. And I think what it really shows is how rapidly companies now can actually go from idea to market. And the only ingredient which was added is effectively AI to do the product development, right? So what we are seeing is that shrinking of the cycle, and also that you raise less money, right? I mean, because your labor force is much faster and is much more productive. So you cut the time down and the output goes up. And so I think that's a really interesting phenomenon now. I think we are getting from, you know, I needed to build my data center to I can get a computer on the cloud to, you know, I can build a business by myself. And so I think the entrepreneurial rate and also the number of experiments which can be run by VCs is going to go up. Now, on the flip side, that has a really interesting impact on the VC world, because if they write smaller checks, they need to write many more checks to get returns. So the VC world will also have to change to address, you know, like instead of funding 10 companies, I fund 100 or 1,000. How do you do that? Right? So I think that whole industry is also up for disruption.
Yeah, it's going to be super interesting to see if it like becomes so low cost to effectively launch a startup. And you want to cover as many startups as possible. I think at some point it almost becomes impossible for them to put, you know, a check into everybody, kind of. I think it's a big deal.
And I mean, we already see this with the Y Combinators of the world, right? So it's just a massive meat market, and then, you know, people put their chips down.
Well, that's all the time that we have for today. I'm always very mind blown by how many topics we cover in a relatively short period of time. Chris, Phaedra, Volkmar, thanks for joining us. Thanks for joining us, listeners. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we'll see you next week on Mixture of Experts.